This is an ABC podcast.
Ia orana manuia le taiao and good morning. You're tuning into Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We give special acknowledgement that our show is produced from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. We focus on the Pacific region, talking to leaders, newsmakers and people who make the Pacific Beat. And we hope you're enjoying the music too. For your Thursday, while residents of PNG are fed up over the political instability of their country and the latest on Fesback in Hawaii, and if there's not enough drama coming out of Fiji's politics, maybe a documentary about it is exactly what you'll need. More on those stories shortly, and you can find our top stories by typing Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. And don't forget to check us out on Facebook and Instagram via ABC Pacific. If it is your first time tuning in, welcome. I'm your host, Egi Tupo, and I say korabua. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin in Vanuatu, where its people have voted for change, with more than half of voters endorsing a proposal to change the constitution and bring about political stability. The result of a historical referendum was announced yesterday evening, but for many communities, there's uncertainty about what impact it will have on their lives. The ABC's Leah Loanbu with more.
After days of delay, the result of Vanuatu's national referendum was announced by the chairman of Vanuatu's Electoral Commission. Edward Kaltomat says the referendum was a success and there was overwhelming support for changing the constitution.
Electoral Commission
The Electoral Commission now declares that the proposed Article 17A is supported by the referendum by 59.28% of the total valid vote cast. Article B is supported by this referendum by 59.98% of total valid votes.
The changes to the two articles allow for the termination of MPs who change political parties, and it compels independent MPs to join a political party. The changes aim to end horse trading that saw Vanuatu go through three prime ministers in just 6 months last year. Dr. Tess Newton-Kane, an expert in Pacific politics, says the ball is in the government's court now.
You know, we'll now see what that means in terms of the machinery of how, for example, political parties have to get themselves organised to be in compliance with the new legislation around how what political parties have to look like and what they need to do in terms of governance. I think that will be a fairly obvious implication.
But in communities around the capital, Port Vila, there's uncertainty about what the result means.
We don't know if it will serve Vanuatu or Vanuatu will change or it will make this government rule against us. We don't know if this will turn up good or bad.
When I voted yes, because a lot of the time when a government gets into power, they don't fulfill their promises, and suddenly the government changes again, and different parties take over. This is why I believe it's better to have a government that serves its term.
The question remains whether the government who pushes for this referendum will make the future of our young people and children better. That would be great. I wish the tomorrow of Vanuatu will change.
The participation rate in the referendum has yet to be disclosed by the Electoral Commission. Dr. Tess Newton-Kane suggests there could also be legal action to gain clarity.
I would be very surprised if we didn't see more legal action seeking legal clarification and possibly legal challenges of that over the next little while.
She says that moving forward, political parties must ensure that proper governance system are in place by the next general election.
The milestone that we're aiming for is that all of these things are in place and everyone understands the implications of them before the country goes to the vote, it goes to voting again.
And that's Dr. Tess Newton-Kane from Griffith University, ending that report from Leah Loanbu. Well, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape last week survived yet another push to hold a no-confidence vote against him, with the process now in the hands of the country's Supreme Court. It is the second time the Marape government has successfully delayed the process, triggering questions over the future stability of the country. And on the streets of Port Moresby, residents are fed up. Papua New Guinea reporter Belinda Cora has the story.
The vote of no confidence for the past week has dominated political debate and the headlines in Papua New Guinea. But on the streets of the capital, Port Moresby, residents and business owners say it is an unwelcome distraction. Alice Tumu sells lamp flaps in Port Moresby's suburb of Boroko. She says she wants change. She feels life in the city has become a little too expensive for her, and that the government has forgotten about the needs of the people.
The increasing prices of goods in shops is one thing I want to talk about. Parliament is supposed to have some of the best leaders who are supposed to look at these increases and do something about it, because life in Port Moresby is getting harder.
But it's not just the government being blamed. Rebecca Pasingan, a worker in Port Moresby, says she's disappointed with the opposition's role in the saga.
They should have adhered to the process, made sure everything was in place. They should have done their due diligence, checked everything and then submitted it. To make a mistake for the second time, the first time was missing a name and getting the numbering wrong, and then the second time was not paying attention to detail and getting the name wrong. That's not good enough.
The opposition's attempt to deliver its motion on the floor failed in last week's session of Parliament over the procedural inconsistencies, with the Speaker adjourning Parliament until September. But now it is headed to court. It is requesting the Supreme Court to issue an order to Speaker Job Poma to recall Parliament within 7 days as one of the relief sought in a constitutional reference filed on Monday. Dr. Orovu Sepoy, a longtime female political expert, has been watching the process closely.
This is not the first time we've had a motion of vote of no confidence, and people should know the procedures and processes so that when it's to be moved on the floor of Parliament, it happens as it should and not be withheld because of procedural oversight. And so that's a big disappointment for our people, and it doesn't help people's trust in the MPs themselves and the Parliament itself as well.
Dr. Sepoy is also critical of the hotel camps set up during the no-confidence vote process.
So the practice of keeping MPs in camps at hotels is a clear indication of lack of trust among MPs themselves, and especially for each member of parliament to decide on the basis of their own conscience. And so the current process has dragged on due to some oversight in the procedures and processes by the opposition, as we hear from the media. But again, that's a disappointment because
Governor of East Sepik Province, Alan Bird, was selected as the alternate prime minister for the opposition in earlier times if the no-confidence vote was successful. Despite the uncertainty over the process and the criticism from the public, he says the vote gives the people of Papua New Guinea an alternate path.
And people keep feeling the pain. What are people going to think of us? They're going to think that we don't care about what's happening to the people because, you know, we're not doing anything about it. And that's the other thing. The vote of no confidence gives hope to the people, so they don't riot in the street, they don't go destroy things. They're like, okay, look, the members of parliament are doing something, so let's wait and see if, you know, they can do something. But if they see us doing nothing, imagine how they're going to feel. So this is the way you've got to look at a vote of no confidence. It's not just about the prime minister.
As the Supreme Court mulls over its future, Dr. Sepoy says votes of no confidence do have a place in Papua New Guinea if the process is transparent.
It can be effective if members of parliament deciding for themselves based on their conscience, based on their observation of how the current government has functioned and especially the Prime Minister. And so its effectiveness can only be tested if individual parliamentarians are not pulled into camps and that they decide for themselves. Because when they convene in two camps, it's quite clear that, as you know, in PNG politics, it becomes a money game as well. And that's not a good reason.
And that's Dr. Orivoy Sepoy, a political expert, ending that report by Belinda Cora in Port Moresby. Pacific Beat. That's right. We here at Pacific Beat have been bringing you the latest news and views of the 13th Pacific Arts and Cultural Festival in Hawaii. And with only 3 days left of FestPack, we thought we'd check in with the Pacific team to see what they've been up to. Hopefully not too many cocktails, I hope. So joining us live from Hawaii is co-host of the Pacific TV show, Alice Lolohe. Did I say, Malo tamae pongpongi ni fe fe tako?
Oh, I'm very well, half a day, Aggie. It's good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's good to hear yours too. I appreciate you joining us this morning. Look, we know that there has been untolds of amazing things that have been happening there at FestPack, but gosh, could you at least just share maybe some of the sights, some of the sounds that, you know, that you yourself and the team have been able to experience so far at FestPack?
Absolutely. I do have to begin by saying it's been overwhelming. meeting all these people, all these talented creatives, all these people who are passionate about sharing their culture in one place. I've been loto mafana since the start of this festival. But one of my highlights has to be we went to Bishop Museum, where a lot of the carvers and the te tau artists are placed. And we were surprised to find a Tongan tātātau artist, you know. Tātātau was banned in Tonga for so long because of the Vava'u Code, and this man, his name's Aisea Toitu'u, he's reviving that, and he was actually part of the 90s revival of tribal tattoo, island tattooing, and that's why we see a lot of the sleeves on guys' arms these days. Yes. He was part of that movement. Yeah, so we got to sit down and chat with him, and he himself was emotional because it's the first time the Tongan delegation for a FestPack has actually invited a tātātau artist to join them. And so the fact that it was him who was asked, he was quite emotional being there. But we got to see a live demonstration of him, you know, showing the tapping method. It was insane. That's probably the first time I've ever seen a Tongan artist do that.
I love that, Alice. Look, and you talk about tātātau or te tau, which is, I hear, a little bird told me that you somehow have had a personal experience in regards to a te tau, if you don't mind sharing with our listeners this morning.
Yes, it was incredible. So the wonderful Tyler Vial, you know, who ABC Pacific has spoken to before. She's also here, not as part of any FestPack delegation, but she came to learn from the tātātau artists who were here. And look, she happened to be taking bookings, and so I got myself in there. But it was that experience was incredible because it's not just, you know, it's not like walking into a tattoo parlor and, you know, you just pick your design and sit down and get a tattoo. Tyler really took the time to understand my story and, you know, what I wanted to have, you know, marked on me, and also to gauge whether I was ready to receive my tātātau.
Right.
And I'm getting a little bit emotional even just speaking about it, you know, because I shared, you know, a story of my grandma growing up with my grandma in Tonga, but also because my uncle actually passed away on the day we left to come here to Hawaii. So I thought I'd honour him in my tātātau as well.
That is a beautiful thing to share. And thank you so much for sharing such a vulnerable part of, you know, this journey that you took. And I cannot wait to see the beautiful to tell that you got Ellis. And, you know, you talk about this whole emotion because we've seen so many emotional speeches being made at FESPAC. You know, speeches about identity, the importance of culture and solidarity. I mean, goodness, why is this event bringing so many tears to a lot of people's eyes?
I know. I know every so we're currently making a small documentary at the moment, not just about FESPAC, but also, you know, about all the artisans and delegates who have come here for the festival. And it's incredible to me that the stories that they're sharing about their own culture and art forms. And I just see there's so many similarities. You know, we aren't divided by this ocean. We're actually united by this great Pacific Ocean. And yesterday we spoke to he's a carver, a Hawaiian carver, and also a tatau artist. His name's Jordan, and he's actually taken a whole bunch of his students down to Bishop Museum to go and see how the carvers from around the Pacific also work. But this guy was just so passionate. The students that he brings in, you know, a lot of them come from boys' homes from around the island. You know, some of them perhaps can't afford to be going to school, so he invites them to come to the community college to take part. And for him, you know, it's not about being paid for his work. For him, it was about making sure that they understand their own kupuna, you know, their own history, culture, and knowledge to pass on, because he felt that for them to have this knowledge, it's not just about, you know, carving out and building all these little knickknacks. You're carving and shaping and forming people as well. And we had the opportunity to meet some of the students, and you could just see how much love they put into their work, but also the mana that they bring to that work as well. And I'm getting emotional just sharing that story with you, but there's so many stories like that. And yes. I think, gosh, honestly, I almost feel like this festival needs to be every 2 years, because the way that everyone is just so mafana meeting each other, it's I can't even explain the depth of my emotion to you, Aggie. It's incredible.
I can hear it and I can feel it, which is a beautiful thing when we are there representing, you know, who we are as a people. And like you say, you have been working on some stories while there, and you've already shared some now, but any other stories that sort of stand out or show a little bit of significance about one person's story?
Oh my gosh, who to begin with? I'm sure Johnson might have mentioned this when he was on the show last week, the couple from Guam. We finally learnt the proper indigenous name for Guam is Guahan. We also spoke to a Torres Strait Islander artist, Solomon Booth, who's here, and he was showing us all these incredible linographs that he's made. But the thing I really loved about his journey is that this isn't his first FESPAC. So he was seeing the young ones that he had originally looked after, you know, at past FESPACs. He's now seeing them coming up the ranks and now leading the next generation. And he was like, that's proof that these things are important, because, you know, they see the importance of sharing the culture as well and making sure it stays alive. But one person who didn't quite make the documentary that I ran into is actually, and you know him as well, his name's John Utanga. He is, yes. You know, he's massive, you know, influence in Pacific media in New Zealand, of Cook Island descent. We ran into him a couple of days ago, and he was actually telling us that he started coming to FESPAC when he was 8. Because his auntie was a teacher in Fiji, so she brought, you know, the Fijian delegation, the students over to perform for that. So he's been coming to FESPAC since he was a child, and he's just been watching this festival evolve and grow. And he was there when, you know, it was held in the Cook Islands and the waka ceremony was first introduced to the festival, and now it's continued. So he was saying he's just blown away by how bigger and better it gets, but also seeing the culture evolve as well. You know, we're seeing a lot more integration of like modern ways, you know, how does this next generation share their culture? You know, they're in, including like contemporary dance and things like that. So he said, yes, there's a shift from traditional to modern, but you know, the traditional elements are still there. And yeah, he's enjoying watching it grow.
Yeah, well, look, we did see a little bit of controversy around, you know, our beautiful brothers and sisters from Fiji in regards to the performance that they did at the opening ceremony. But look, I understand that.
Yeah, I think in regards to, I mean, I do understand the backlash, but at the same time, you know, how else do we get the culture to stay alive? Because that happens in every culture across the world. You know, that's how culture evolves. We incorporate, you know, the modernity into it. And it's not to say that they're neglecting all the traditional, but it is a new style of, you know, it is a new way to take it in. And I think, to be honest, I could see how passionate in Mafana they were on the stage as well. Mm. And I had the opportunity to watch them perform in the convention center the other day. And In my humble opinion, it doesn't make them any less Pacific, but I'm sure we will have the traditionalists come forward to say, actually, no, that's not how you do it. But I thought that they were a beautiful representation of Fiji and the Pacific.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that, Alice. And look, you know, as we wrap up, I know there's only pretty much 3 days left of FestPack, which I'm sure you guys are going to be so have many withdrawals. But what can we expect? You know, even I suppose even the closing ceremony. If the opening ceremony was amazing, I can only imagine the closing one. But yeah, but please let us know what else are you guys looking forward to before you return.
Well, the main thing we're looking forward to, because you know, the closing ceremony, yes, it's going to be a spectacle, but you know, everyone on the ground here is sort of wondering, where is the next FestPack going to be held?
Yes.
Because the next one was supposed to be held in Kanaki in New Caledonia, but you know, with the turmoil that's going on there, you know, people are wondering whether it's still going to happen. And then, of course, we've got other Pacific countries coming forward to make a bid for 2032. So that's what we're waiting to hear. Where will the next couple of FestPacks be? And yeah, because everyone's so excited for it to happen again. Yeah, I'm interested to see how these bids are going to go.
Absolutely. Oh, let's hope I get to go next time. But I do. I do want to quickly just ask, though, I know the show is on tonight. If you don't mind sharing, what can people or our listeners expect to see on the show tonight, and where should they actually tune in?
Oh, we wrapped last week, but they can definitely tune in on iView and also via YouTube, ABC In Depth, to watch the full episodes. Yes, we're currently on a break at the moment just to work on our documentary. So we're excited to share that documentary with you all. So hopefully everyone could experience a little bit of what we did here in Honolulu, Hawaii.
Alice, mālo e ngāi ofa mihina. Thank you so much for just the hard work that you guys are doing and obviously sharing the stories of our Pacific people. We really appreciate your time on our show this morning.
Mālo apito, Aggie.
No worries. That, of course, is our co-host of the Pacific TV program, Alice Lolo, here. And please remember, you can find all the highlights of FestPack on our Facebook and Instagram pages via ABC Pacific.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Bobby McCumber, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same, from cricket to netball, athletics to rugby, and everything in between.
Fresh Off the Field, Thursday afternoon at 4 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. The mammoth task of resettling thousands of people displaced by the Enga landslide is underway following a geological assessment of the disaster site. Geotechnical experts from New Zealand have said the area is at imminent risk of more landslides and would be uninhabitable for at least 10 years. Meanwhile, a work began yesterday to rebuild a critical road leading into the Pagera Valley, where close to 100,000 people are cut off from supplies. Enga Provincial Administrator Zandis Zaka spoke with Carl Evans to provide the latest.
The main supply route into the Pogoro Valley which is another 100,000 population beyond that landslip, is run into food shortages and fuel shortages. So while we have brought in relief measures to airlift supplies and food rations into the valley, our immediate task is to get the road open at some time so we can get supplies and especially fuel into Pogora. So we've mobilized our engineers and team on the ground to coordinate with the community and the team on the ground to open up access into Pogora.
Will the area that was affected by the landslide, will that be uninhabitable going forward?
The advice from our geotech engineers is the high-risk areas that they've recommended evacuation cannot have community settled there for the next 10 years. So it is a major recommendation, and we've advised the community that they can't live in the high-risk areas because the advice from geotech is the land is prone to further landslides and a movement of rock and other debris. There's still cracks in the mountain ridge where the landslide happened.
And 10 years is a long time. And in the meantime, how is that evacuation effort going?
It is a challenge when you're trying to relocate people from their homes and livelihoods where they've lived for generations. So while we have that challenge, the people are aware of the risk that they and their families face if they continue to live in that area. The magnitude and the impact of the landslide is not lost upon the people. So while there's the hesitation, we're trying to move them and getting them to move to what has been identified as safer areas. The community is responding well. Those communities that do not have their own customary land within the safe areas to move into, the government is doing social mapping. We've identified other lands within the area in the proximity of the villages that were impacted, but owned by other clans and tribes within the area that we've spoken to, and they're happy to release their land to the government. So our Department of Lands and officers on the ground have started to do assessments and surveys with a view to acquire the land for those that are displaced and have no place within the safe areas to settle.
It's great to hear that generosity is taking place. On the flip side, though, there has obviously been a lot of tribal conflicts in the past. Is there fear that some of this mass displacement might lead to further conflict?
That's always a risk that we've been mindful from the day one. The areas within that landslip area and the surrounding villages are volatile areas in terms of tribal conflicts that are ongoing. Part of our response on the ground has been to mitigate the risk associated with that by having two separate care centers where people can move to where they feel safer. So part of our engagement in resettling people is also identifying two blocks of land, one on either side, so people can be settled into an area where they feel safer.
Now, in terms of the longer term, I know this is going to be a huge effort from everybody involved. And when I look at some of the resources that provincial governments have, it's not a lot compared to the national government. Going forward, do you think you'll lobby for more resources from the national government so provincial governments are better able to respond to natural disasters in the future?
Yes, the experiences of the Muritoka disaster has actually brought to light our shortcomings in both in terms of operational and policy capacity, and also in terms of manpower and resourcing capacity at both the national and provincial level. We have become a bit more prone to natural disasters, not just landslide. So we've had a few major disasters in the country, and I think there's an awakening that as a country, both at the national and provincial level, we need to be better prepared. And we are encouraged, actually, that the national government is working very closely with us because of those resource challenges and things. We have had engagement with the national government, who have agreed to set up Muritoka Restoration Authority. It is a piece of legislation that will go before Parliament to set up that authority. What that authority will do is it will have a mandate, specific mandate, in undertaking the next phase of reconstruction, resettlement, rehabilitation of services and infrastructure. So there'll be a partnership between the provincial government, and we're working on a medium to long-term strategy on what that will look like in terms of actual development programs on the ground. But to drive that agenda, I think setting up getting the agreement of the national government to set up the Muritoka Restoration Authority with a single focus on, you know, carrying out rehabilitation and restorative works in the Muritoka is a step in the right direction.
That authority, that'll be some sort of a headquarters in which to coordinate disaster response efforts in the future. Is that sort of what that is?
No, the response specifically for the Muritaka landslide.
I see.
As we look at the long-term restorative efforts in the Muritaka area, landslide area, to restore public services, public infrastructure, and rebuild lives in the community that have been impacted. The massive evacuation that is happening that will have a tenure, we need an entity as primary focus on that, on the disaster and the restoration works that will happen. So we're looking to bring legislation at the next sitting of parliament, which is expected to be in September, to set up this authority to have the primary focus of rebuilding Muritaka going forward.
That was Inga Provincial Administrator Sandis Tsaka speaking to reporter Carl Evans.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Solomon Islands was the toast of the region, spending millions to host last year's Pacific Games. And 7 months on, new Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele is digging deep and cutting costs to raise much-needed revenue. As Krishnarita Almanuliong in Honiara reports, boosting the economy is key to the government's new 100-day strategy.
Jeremiah Manele is a seasoned diplomat at home in the delicate world of diplomacy and negotiation. But as Prime Minister, his focus is now on the country's ailing economy.
I stand before you today to introduce or launch two crucial documents that will guide our nation's journey towards unity, transformation and sustainable development. These documents are the 100 Days Programme and the Policy Statement document for the government.
In front of an audience of MPs, diplomats and the business community, he unveiled a 34-page plan to improve the economy and drive up government revenue.
The focus will be to enhance financial stability through strengthening tax compliance, tighten discretionary exemptions, review modes relating to mining companies and ensure quality spending. The procurement process will also be monitored to ensure government purchases reflect value for money and quality outcomes.
His predecessor, Manasseh Songavare, spent millions of government funds to host last year's Pacific Games. Now, as Finance Minister, Songavare is looking to cut costs.
We need to tighten up these things so that government can serve them.
We need to tighten up government revenue so that the government can do what it's meant to do. There's a lot of big things said in this document, and that's my concern as the finance minister, because I'll need to look for the money to implement these things.
The private sector is often referred to as the engine of the economy, but it's often left out of policy discussions. The chair of Chamber of Commerce, Namoi Kaluwai, says it's time for change.
Private sector is very important for economic produce.
Private sector is important for the economy of a country, not just in terms of revenue, but it's the partnership with the government in the form of dialogue, advice and suggestions on how to move forward, and that's something I believe the government should use as its leverage.
Ms. Kaluwai wants members of the private sector to take part in cabinet subcommittees.
This one here mainly for also one for a focal point.
To keep the decision makers informed on the issues affecting those in the private sector. This way we can actively participate together in policy formation through this subcommittee so the government can make good decisions in the best interest of the economy.
As for the Prime Minister, he hopes the 100-day policy can be an investment in the country's future.
They reflect our collective aspirations and our commitment to building a prosperous, united and resilient nation.
And that is Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele ending that report from Krishnarita Almanuliong in Honiara. Well, if you've been on social media this week, there's been no lack of drama playing out in Fiji's politics with the resignations of the leaders of Fiji First, which is the largest political party in the country. Now, the demise of Fiji First, who have been in power since 2014, didn't just happen overnight. If you look back at the national elections 2 years ago, that was when Fijians voted against the once dominant party. And it's those elections that are the subject of a new documentary set to premiere tonight in Fiji. So joining me this morning are the producers of Elections in Paradise, Dave Lavaki and Meli Tunkota. With that I say, Bula Vinaka, and welcome to the show, guys.
Bula. Thank you very much for having us.
Absolutely. Really appreciate it. I mean, look, hey, you two certainly have good timing launching it on the same week that Fiji's largest political party appears to be imploding. Is this a coincidence?
Listen, no joke. I was actually typing up an invite to send to, like a flyer to send to the various parties. And Fiji First was the first one on my list because Fiji First. And then I happened to be on Twitter and I saw, you know, the news just exploded. And I was like, no way. This can't be happening. Guys, I'm about to send this invite out. So let it never be said that Fiji politics is anything but, you know, happening, yeah. That's for sure.
Thank you for that, Meli. Look, obviously with this whole documentary, how would you even describe, like, the style of it? I mean, is it a serious current affairs, or is this some sort of new style of doco that you guys have put together?
It's really like a vlog style documentary. So like if you consider like what do you call, like, maybe orthodox kind of journalism, this is the absolute opposite of that. It's really just Meli and I kind of running around trying to understand this, go to rallies, experience rallies for the first time together, but also on camera. So it's we've tested it in front of a few different smaller audiences, and the way they all kind of refer to it is like, it's like a learning journey for Meli and I, but it's also like a learning journey for the audience that, you know, might not necessarily be exposed to these kinds of, you know, go to rallies and aren't exposed to politics, like, from this kind of, from the inside like this.
Yeah. I mean, what was the inspiration, though, for both of you? And you can both answer this. I mean, you know, to have to co-direct this type of documentary.
Well, we were approached by the University of London. They had they were putting together an exhibition called Living Democracy, and they were gathering material from five different countries around the world that showcased what politics was to you know, the people. And so Fiji was one of those teams. That was us, Dave and I. And so initially we were brought on to do three videos following politicians around. And as luck would have it, it was the Fiji general elections. And so although it was going to be a sort of, like, you know, a straightforward video where we'd follow politicians and put them in a more like a different light to show that they're actually just people just like us. During the lead up to elections, the writ of elections, which enables all the parties to go out and campaign, hadn't been issued yet. So none of the parties wanted to talk to us. So we were a bit nervous about, like, hey, you know, we're actually brought on to do this and we can't actually do it. Are we going to get in trouble? And the university anthropology unit that actually brought us on, they said, look, why don't you turn the cameras on yourselves and interview yourself? And I'm like, well, we don't know anything about politics. And then we both looked at each other and were like, we actually don't know anything about politics. That's actually a good start. And so that's how the whole angle of the documentary turned in. So it became Dave and I's journey to learn about Fiji politics during the general elections. And so that's what we came up with.
Wow. Dave, I do want to come to you then. Look, the script is written in a very humorous and conversational manner. Is that the language and the level that you really want to reach your audience?
Yeah, I think just adding on to what Meli said, when we worked on this film, a lot of the stuff, some of the comments when we first played it in England was, you know, like, for Fijians that have been brought up overseas, when their view of Fiji politics, you know, the first things that come to mind are like, coups, is this, is that, you know, it's quite, you know, if you just watch it through the media, it can be quite clinical or sterile. Eh? But actually, when you go through, even though you have serious situations like that here on the ground, it's really still Pacific. Eh? It's still very lighthearted. We still can laugh about it. We still can laugh at ourselves about it. So the film really kind of, in my head, the film really looks at it or captures that kind of, you know, the country vibe, I guess, quite well. So even though it's like, oh, this is a major election, this is a government that was there for 16 years. There's this big kind of movement to change, but there's also this big kind of friction not to change among the people. while there's, you know, when you read it in the media, it can feel like there's a lot of tension. Actually, when you go and talk to people on the ground, people still joke about it and laugh about it, and it's quite light, you know. So it is some, you know, some kind of serious issues, and it's serious in that kind of sense. But at the same time, we know how to kind of just take it easy. We're still islanders, eh? And I think that the doco does that in it kind of captures that and portrays that. In a sense.
Well, I do obviously, you know, probably not just a Fijian thing. It's probably right across the board of Pacific people. We somehow seem to find humor in even the most serious moments. But, and this is why I want to get into a serious part, because, you know, we had our correspondent in Fiji yesterday tell us that Fiji First appears to be on its deathbed. Is that something that you both share the sentiment?
When we got into this project, initially, like I said, like I don't really know anything about politics. When we finished the project, although I wouldn't say I'd call myself an expert, I definitely was a lot more aware and following a lot more of the ongoings of politics. And so watching the Fiji First Party crumble in real time was kind of surreal for me, because, you know, we went to their rallies, we interviewed people. They won, you know, the majority number of seats by themselves. So it was crazy to see that, you know, they represented the majority of Fiji, but their party fell apart. So it was a surreal moment to watch that, having known the kind of ground support that they had, at least, yeah, from my end.
Thank you for that, Melly. If you're just tuning in to Pacific Beat, we're talking about a documentary premiering tonight in Fiji, Elections in Paradise. We're joined by the producers, Dave Lovaki and Melly Tunkotha. You know, when you were filming back in 2022, what was the mood of the country back then? And I suppose how it even differs to how it is now? I mean, is there a lot more disappointment or even optimism?
I think I think in 2022, one of the things was we did a lot of the filming we did on our phone. I think there was, especially during the thick of the elections, a lot of people were kind of shy or not comfortable to go on camera. And I think a lot of it has to do with just, you know, disagreements within their own families or amongst their own friends. So it's instead of, what their concern is like, if I vote for this party, I'm worried that my friends will be upset about it. And you see that on social media. So I think that was the funny thing about 2022, the general elections in 2022. People, I think since then, from my news feeds, from my feeds on social media, people have been a lot more open and a lot more. Since then, people have been kind of really speaking up and discussing things quite openly on social media. So that's quite interesting. I don't know if it has, I can't say that it, you know, it's because of the past government or not. But yeah, in 2022, it was when we were going around, one of the hard things was actually trying to get interviews. And it's one of the reasons we had to turn the cameras on ourselves. Because we just weren't getting a lot of content, context, etc. And so we had to fill in a lot of those gaps.
Wow. Melly, if I come to you, what was the big takeaway then for yourself? At the end of this project, what is it that you're hoping people are going to take away when they watch this documentary?
I'm hoping they come away with similar sentiments that I had going into it, because for a lot of us, politics is just something that you see happen on the news, and then you think it doesn't like quite affect you. But if you actually pay attention and sort of like pay a lot more attention to how politics works, it's the fact that the government works for you, and the decisions they make are affected by your input. And so I'm hoping that with this documentary, at the very least, it'll inspire people to participate a bit more in their government's decisions, to make their voices heard, because it's, as a democracy, the government's supposed to listen to you. And so if you're unhappy about something, you know, don't complain on Facebook, complain on the government page's Facebook, you know, make your voice heard. And so that's at least what my takeaways and my hope is. I'm not going to change the world. We're not going to all of a sudden, you know, hold hands and sing Kumbaya. But at the very least, make people a bit more interested and a bit more participating in how the government works.
Dave, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. What is it that you're hoping people will take away?
Well, I don't know. I think there's lots of things to take away, but I think personally for me, one of the biggest things that I learned on that journey, and it's a bit of a weird one. It's the, you know, when we talk about politics being a dirty, you know, it's a dirty game or it's a dirty thing. A lot of times we look at it like, you know, politicians not keeping up to their promises. One of the things that I learned in this, in going out to film, was actually the commitment made by, you know, independent politicians or politicians that are coming in for the first time, the candidates that are coming in for the first time. A lot of these guys go in with the notion or with kind of riding on the hype that their family or their friends have given them. And they go, yeah, you should stand, you should run. And, you know, we're all going to support you. And they go, okay. And it actually costs these individuals a lot of money and a lot of time. And they have to resign from their jobs and all those kind of things. But the actual promise from the people, when they say, one of the guys we interviewed, he said, you know, from this place here, I was expecting to get at least 15 votes because my family's there. I only got one vote from that station. You know, Lenore Rengerenger Tambo, who's now the deputy speaker of the house, she talks about her village. Her village, she only got two votes from her entire village. You know, and I think she's the only candidate from her village. So for me, the thing that, you know, it was like a flip on the idea of politics being a dirty game. It's not just about the promise that the politicians make us, but us as a people, when we hype somebody and we say, oh yeah, you come here and we're going to come and support you and rally behind you. A lot of times it's actually, what we're going to do in the booth is quite opposite. So that was an eye-opener for me.
Yeah. It sounds like it's going to be an exciting watch. Look, quickly, we've only got about a minute left, but if you both don't mind sharing, I know it's premiering tonight in Fiji, but where could the rest of the Pacific and the world be able to view this doco?
So we're having the premiere in Fiji, but we're also planning right now to take the film to Australia and New Zealand. Been getting a lot of requests to screen to Australia and New Zealand. So we're actually in the middle of that, and we'll definitely release news of confirmed locations in both Australia and New Zealand as they get confirmed. So definitely keep your eyes peeled, all you as Aussie and ZK. As for online, we're planning to submit it to a few film festivals, but after we do the film festival circuit, we'll definitely have it online for the rest of the world to see.
Cannot wait to watch it. Look, I just want to say vinaka vakalevo for the beautiful work that you both are doing, and all the best for the premiere tonight.
Thanks so much.
Naka, thank you.
No worries. That, of course, is the producers of Elections in Paradise, Dave Lavaki and Meli Thunkotha, here on Pacific Beat.
Ekamowia Romo Naru, we're thrilled to let you know ABC Radio Australia is now broadcasting to your island home. Tune in to 90FM for the latest Pacific news, sports, conversations and music. And if you know someone who lives on Nauru, let them know they can now listen on 90FM. From the team at ABC Radio Australia, Ekamowi Romo and welcome Nauru, ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. I'll be back next week, Monday morning at 6 a.m. because tomorrow it's your sports edition with Richard Hewitt on a Friday. But you can tune in again this afternoon at 5 p.m. at PNG time. Stay tuned because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. Until next time, o toa awhaatu, have an amazing weekend. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and this is Pacific Beat.